Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. It's midday.
It's actually midday as well.
This only just occurred to us. It's occurred to us this week, out of all the weeks, that actually we could just do it. We already do it as live, but it's not quite live. It only just occurred to us this week that we could actually start at 12 and then we don't have to sort of like do the maths. We can just literally say it starts at 12. It's a whole 48 hours early.
Exactly.
For us, for you, it's bang on time. Or whenever you want to listen to it, you don't have to be a slave to the gods of the clock.
But you could always listen to it at midday every week on a day of your choosing.
You can just listen to it live. Listen to it live on the radio station.
Yeah, that's the other option, isn't it? You can always just listen to it as normal.
Yeah, listen to it as normal. I mean, that's how I'd do it. But it's also, you know, it doubles up as a podcast and you might be listening to that. But as normal, you're listening to Fan Club with me, Nick Helm. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram on The Nick Helm, at The Nick Helm. And then you're also listening to, this is my co-host.
Yeah, that's right.
So how do you describe yourself?
Well, I guess,
when, you know, like, let's say you're going to, like, you're at a wedding.
Yeah, I say I'm Nick Helm's co-host.
Yeah, that right. Yeah. Okay, cool. You're all right with that.
Yeah. If I meet someone new, so what you do for a living, I say, well, not for a living. I want to do for, the money. I say I'm Nick Helm's co-host.
Okay. Oh, do you know what then, Nat? That's fine with me. All right.
Okay. Oh, okay. I didn't realize I need permission.
Well, I think that, you know, if they ask me, it's important that I don't just blurt out, oh, he's my sidekick.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I say co-host.
Co-host. Yeah. If we're co-hosts, we're on equal footing, aren't we?
Well, okay. If you want to be called a co-host, I'll start treating you like one.
Though I have noticed.
What have we got coming up on the show today, Nathaniel?
What have we got coming up today? Well, we've got some fan
absolutely
mail.
Treading water for time. One day, Nathaniel. What have you noticed?
Well, this week we're going to have some fan mail. And we're going to have a guest, and we're going to have an Alice Cooper track, and we're going to have our guest track.
And I could have told you this, but, you know, that's why I'm the host.
Well, can you still be the host and I be the co-host? Or does that not make sense?
Sub-host.
Sub-host.
I think that's what you might be.
There's on the FUBA, on the logo for Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club, it's got Nick Helm, and it's all in a square, so it kind of makes sense. It's all in a square. It's all in the same shapes. It's got Nick Helm. It's got Fan Club in big writing. But because Nathaniel Metcalf, I presume it's because it's a long name. My name is shrunk, isn't it? To tiny...
Tiny letters.
Like tiny letters to fit it in.
Do you know what? It's the fact that you've got a long name is purely coincidental.
Right.
when we signed the contract.
Yeah.
Originally.
Yeah.
When we signed them, it was very much like a Paul Newman, Steve McQueen situation.
Right, yeah.
They said, do you want them both the same size? Equal size, but do you want to go left to right, Nick Helm, Nathaniel Metcalf, and top to bottom, it'll be Nathaniel Metcalf, Nick Helm. Nathaniel Metcalf will be slightly higher. And I said, no, make it as small as you can. And they said, well, actually, that helps, because if it's that small, then it looks quite nice in a square. And I said, I don't give a shit about shapes. Yeah, could be a star for all I care. Could be a rhombus, right? Just make it smaller. And they did, God bless them. And now 400 and 90 episodes later, and
I've got tiny, and tiny writing.
Here we are. Here we are, and we're doing
it. On the Persuaders, the Tony Curtis, Roger Moore TV show, I think before they started, they were having lots of kind of heated debates over who would be top billing on that show.
Tony Curtis, right?
I think in the end, they settled for, I think each week, someone else gets top billing.
That's a ball ache, isn't it? They should have just said Roger Moore, because it was a British, was it a British TV show?
Yeah, yeah.
They should have said Roger Moore, and then, and Tony Curtis. And Tony Curtis would have got, like, to just, like, swan in and just do his bit.
Yeah. But I think apparently they got on really well, so it wasn't really an issue. I think they
I think they're very similar, right? Yeah. I think maybe Tony Curtis is slightly more sort of like flamboyant, a bit more of a bit less, modest.
Yes, yeah.
But I think that they're sort of like similar.
Yes, I think so. I think they've got a similar vibe.
And they're like transatlantic cousins, right?
Yes. And I think in a way, like, Moore's probably the kind of person that, despite that, having an argument about billing, he's probably quite an affable person, or was.
While we're just getting warmed up, I should probably just say that we've had some breaking news at Fan Club Towers.
Oh, yeah.
And that is that Roger Moore and Tony Curtis were quite relaxed around each other on the set of The Persuaders.
Oh, wow, that's good to know.
So if you're a long-time listener, you'll know that that is urgent, urgent news on this site, on this channel. I've never seen The Persuaders. Now, first rule of Fan Club, tell your friends. Second rule of Fan Club, tell your friends. We are, I mean, this is a high energy, high octane, high voltage episode. Okay, right. So what have you been a fan of this week? What have I been a fan of this week? What have anyone been a fan of this week? Hopefully we've got some fan mail. I tell you what, we watched Crank this week.
Crank, yes.
Yeah. It's great, isn't it?
Great film. And I think almost doesn't get spoken about as much as it should now for how kind of it feels almost like feels almost groundbreaking, I think, Crank, in a way. I think it's like a proper sort of way ahead of its time, or of its time, that sort of very knowing.
When was it, 2003?
Oh, I thought it was a bit after that, but yeah,
maybe it's a bit after that. It was sort of like handheld digital cameras were becoming really sort of like affordable enough to be able to just, you know, destroy, I suppose. Okay, carry on.
I think the description, it might have been Richard Sandlin who said this, but he said it's basically Speed, but the bus is Jason Statham.
Yeah.
And that's the premise. And it's just such a great, so it's a man who has to keep his heart rate above, what is it, like 50?
He's got to keep his heart rate up. He's sort of like, he's been injected by a poison, and if his adrenaline levels drop, then he dies. So Jason Statham has to go around doing stuff that pumps up his adrenaline. It's like committing crimes and stealing and stuff and doing cocaine and just... Well, he's a bad guy. He's called Chev Chelios, and he's a real bad guy. And he wakes up and he's sort of... he's going to die if he doesn't keep moving. And so he's got like, it's a bit like DOA as well, where he's got to sort of like solve the mystery of who killed him. But it's like a Roadrunner, a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Yeah.
And it's a comedy. I would say that it's an action film, but if you, and it stars Jason Statham, but it's basically this very experimental. What was that really experimental short film about the guy, the Wizard of Time and Speed? The Wizard of Space and Time.
Yeah.
It's sort of a bit like that, where it's kind of like, oh, right, we're going to do the thing. And they're just fucking around with sort of like, at the time, modern technology. And I think that we've seen so much stuff like that because obviously, we have all of the tech. You could make Crank on your phone, basically. Now. Hmm. But we've got all the technology at our fingertips, and it's all over the place. It's on YouTube, and it's on Instagram, and you can see kind of like people making videos like that all the time. But when you go back and watch Crank, it's almost a little bit quaint, because you go, oh, look what they're doing. But you just have to remind yourself, no, this was cutting edge. This was sort of like, they've gone, we're going to make an actual, well, it's not big budget. There's really cute things that you see in it, like the standoff at the end. They're filming in LA, and the standoff at the end is at this posh sort of like balcony bar. But as they're filming there, you can see the sun rising. And the way that the light is hitting them, you know that it's morning sun. So they've all been there since like 2 o'clock in the morning. And they're allowed, you know, they would have, the club would have said, yeah, you can film here, but you have to film here out of hours. So they would have arrived when the club was clearing out. And then they would have all set up. And then they'd have kind of like rehearsed or whatever. And they'd have got all of like the choreography done. And then once the sun was rising, they'd have filmed it. And throughout the sequence, you can see the sun getting higher and higher to the point that it's sort of like midday. And then they'd have been like, right, you're out of here. And then I imagine that they'd have all gone to a diner around the corner, and they'd have all kind of like checked all of their stuff. And they'd have all been kind of like, oh, I can't believe we've done that. We filmed the finale of the movie. And it's kind of like, yeah, you can sort of see the stitching together of like how they made the movie.
Yeah.
Just kind of, that's like one of the things that we've done during lockdown. And I don't know quite why it's come at this point in my life, but like I really enjoy watching adverts or odd films, or even TV adverts. And you can see the joints, and you can kind of like see the production decisions from the back. Mm. And is that Checker Trade advert that you got with Colin Holt in it? They're sort of like the CheckerTrade.com, CheckerTrade.com, CheckerTrade.com. Those adverts, and it's like Colin Holt is dressed up as like Julius Caesar, and there's a Roman guard, and the whole. They did two adverts. The first advert is filmed in a doorway where someone's rang on the door and they've opened it and they're dressed as sort of like Romans and they have a chat. And then the sting at the end when they sing the catchphrase is filmed in a garden. And it's just very enjoyable going, well, they filmed that during COVID, didn't they? During lockdown, where one of them's allowed in the house and the other one's allowed outside the house. They've just filmed it in a doorway with the door open so that it's all COVID safe. And then it says change location. They've just gone to a garden.
Yeah.
And, and you're watching all of like the production decisions and you're kind of like going, I reckon that's what happened. And with Crank, you're kind of, you know, you're kind of like going, oh yeah, well, it's low budget. So they would have literally not asked for permission to do a lot of this stuff because it's all handheld. And then that's where the sun is rising. So they would have got that place for free or for cheap. Yeah.
You probably wouldn't have seen a film like that at the time outside of somewhere like Japanese cinema where you'd get these kind of very odd movies. And this felt like a kind of American version of some of the kind of wild. Yeah, they're kind of wild. Eastern cinema kind of sort of breaking lots of rules and kind of being silly, but playing it. I think it's the origin really of why Jason Statham is such a beloved actor now as well.
Well, it's sort of like the antithesis to Transporter.
Yes.
Although Transporter is sort of like a kissing cousin. It's like, I don't know, Transporter is sort of like off the wall and sort of like, I was going to say wacky, but I don't want to say wacky. It's like El Mariachi.
Hmm.
Sort of like Robert. It's weird that Robert Rodriguez, with all of his skills, went the way of cheap CGI and blue screen, green screen in all of his films. Where in actual fact, he could have been sort of like making Crank kind of movies.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all sort of like hyper low budget. Do you know what I mean? It's like the more money that Robert Rodriguez gets, the sort of like, not wouldn't ever say lazy. I think he's an absolutely incredible director with great imagination, and he's like one of a kind. Like he has his entire film studio in his garage, and he's incredible. But I would say that that he became like really reliant on green screen. I think maybe it was Sin City that did it when he realized that if he just filmed everything.
Well, I think it's that thing where he switched to digital video, wasn't he? Which same kind of thing where he just realized how much easier it is to film stuff with DV cameras and then be able to manipulate them all later. You can just do it much faster, I think, was always his thing, wasn't it? Like, oh, I can do it quicker if I just use DV cameras, scan it all in, and then rely on, you know, fixing it all later.
But when you see Crank, that sort of like was out around the same time as, well, it wasn't quite the same time as what was it called, Grindhouse. But it was, you know, mid to late 2000s. I don't know, it just feels like, whereas with Transporter, it's who directed that? It wasn't Luc Besson, was it?
Was it Louis Leterrier?
Louis Leterrier directed it. It was produced by Luc Besson. Louis Leterrier directed it. And it's very high octane, slick, glossy. This is what an action film looks like. And it's sort of like, there's violence and probably a bit of swearing in it. I can't really remember. It's been a while. But it's kind of like squeaky clean. It's like, oh, he's sort of an anti-hero. He's a driver who transports stuff. They take his cargo, and now he wants it back. But it's sort of like, this is an action movie. He goes around kicking stuff. There's some really great stunts on a level of kind of Jackie Chan type stuff where it's really inventive. But it's sort of like a fun action film with not really many sharp edges. And it looks slick and glossy. Whereas you had Crank, which is coming out, which is his other franchise, which is coming out around the same time. And it's all sort of like jagged edges. He's a horrible character. It feels sort of like dangerous when you're watching it. It's like, it's not a nice film. It's kind of like, and he's playing a bad guy that's going around killing bad guys. And, you know, it's all up for grabs. And it's kind of like, and it's a comedy, I would say.
Yeah, definitely a comedy. And it shows him in a really good light that he signed up to it. Because I can't imagine, it was probably a thing where if he's doing movies like Transporter, I could almost imagine his kind of management being a bit like, nah, maybe don't do this one, Crank. And him kind of obviously seeing what's good about it in it. It feels like a kind of a smart thing to have signed up for because it feels ahead of its time and a bit like, nah, this is a good one. This is going to be good.
It really does, but you have to remind yourself sort of a bit when you're watching it to go like, oh no, this was brand new, because it was so brand new that Ghost Rider had come out, and Ghost Rider was awful, and Ghost Rider was one of them Marvel films before Iron Man, where like it's all CGI, and they've taken like a character about what, a hell demon whose face and skin burns off and turns into a flaming skull. And they've made it into a kid's film and starring Nicolas Cage. And so when they were doing the sequel to Hellboy, they were like, let's get the guys that did Crank. And so so Hellboy 2 is the Crank.
Ghost Rider 2.
Ghost Rider 2 is the Crank directors who, you know, they sort of taped cameras to their hands and got on roller skates and then skated up and down mountains at high speed to simulate like car chases and stuff like that. So, and Nicolas Cage was like, oh yeah, let's do stuff like this. And so there was like this moment where it was a brand new thing and everyone was like, oh, this, if we do it like this, it will reinvigorate our kind of like failing franchise. And that was when Hellboy 1 was, maybe it was a PG or a 12. Sorry, not Hellboy. Ghost Rider 1 was like a PG or a 12. And then Ghost Rider 2 was like aiming to be like an R rating. So it was like either it was a 15 or an 18. Which is not really much of a difference between a 12 and a 15. But yeah, it's more to do with the difference between a PG and a 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of. Oh, then we started watching Crank 2, but it's horrible. It's like every single female character is a sex worker, and the way the camera sort of like moves all over them, it's kind of like, it's really uncomfortable to watch, because you just kind of what's the name of the female actress in that?
I don't remember. No, I can't remember.
She was in the main character in the first film.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's really likable, and she was sort of like of that era. She's really likable, and she's, you know, she's good. And then in the second film, it reveals that she's a stripper, and then she has to do like entire scenes with black tape over her nipples, and then the camera, she's sort of like on all fours, and the camera sort of like really looms in from behind her, and you go, was she aware that they were filming like that while they're doing, because it's all handheld, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
not like, yeah, yeah, they don't have these, sort of shot set up and going,
it's not that, it's big camera that setups, and so it was like, oh, like, it was, we, like, I loved the first one, and then the second one starts, and I guess they're just trying to push the boundaries and be even more edgy and like add loads of, it's like an exploitation film, so it's like, there's loads of sex and it's just, do you know what I mean? It's like, not to get all American on it, but it was the sex that was the most, but it wasn't the fact that there's sex and nudity in it, it was the fact that it felt like, I know it's meant to be an exploitation film, but it did actually feel exploitative.
Yeah. So. Well, the first one has that sex scene, doesn't it, at the racetrack? But it's played for laughs.
It is played for laughs.
That's what's funny about it.
There is a fine line in that, though.
Yeah.
It is sort of like, there is a moment where they explicitly let you know that it's not a rape. And you go, right, okay, I can enjoy the film now.
Right, okay.
There's like this moment where he's trying to have sex with his girlfriend in public and she's resisting. And then there's a moment where she goes, shh, then she's all up for it and she gets taken over and by lust, and, you know, who can resist Jason Statham? But, there is sort of like a moment where it's kind of like, oh, is this going the way I think it's going? Because he's a real bad guy. And then Amy Smart,
yeah, she is good.
She's really great. She's really likable and brilliant. Oh, yeah, she was in Road Trip and Just Friends and Starsky and Hutch. And I don't remember in Starship Troopers, but she was in that also. She's in loads of stuff. Yeah, anyway, so we didn't really get through Crank 2. But anyway, the other thing that we watched was, what was it called? Zodiac. Watch Zodiac. Some good old David Fincher.
I haven't seen Zodiac until fairly recently.
Or ever?
No, I haven't seen it.
I lived with a guy at uni, and maybe around the same, I can't remember when it came out, 2006 or something like that. And a massive David Fincher fan. And I'm kind of like, I'm of the belief that, like, every other David Fincher film is amazing. But then, the odd numbers are fine. And then the even numbers are just like, oh, my God. Alien 3, okay. Fight Club, 7, amazing. The Game, it's okay. Fight Club, oh, incredible. Panic Room, it's all right. Benjamin Button, the most amazing film ever made. I haven't seen Benjamin Button, but it works to a certain point. Zodiac is like, it feels like a 70s sort of.
That's what's nice about it. Yeah. I feel like it's one that's gained a reputation. I don't remember people being as into it as they seem to be now when it came out. But I know people now where it's like in their top favorite films, and you go, really? And that's sort of what inspired me to watch it, like, oh, this has kind of passed me by then, and I really liked it. And I sort of feel like, oh, it's probably the kind of film, if I see it, like, the next time I see it, it will probably really fall into place for me and be like, it is brilliant. I liked it a lot, but, like, I feel like, I reckon it probably takes a couple of watches before you get sucked in. I did enjoy it.
No, I like it. I think it is good, but also because of the amount of TV stuff that's around now, it feels a little bit maybe disposable. And also, he followed it up with his serial killer TV show, didn't he? David Fincher.
Mindhunter.
Was it Mindhunter? That sounds like Mindhorn.
It does. And I saw that recently as well, and I think that's all right. I wasn't as enamoured with it as a lot of people are, I know. But I enjoyed it.
The TV series.
I found it very watchable, but I wasn't, like, bowled over by it. It has a sort of, what I kind of think of, I don't mean this as a negative either, just stylistically, it feels almost old-fashioned to me. Like, it feels a bit like network TV-ish than a lot of stuff does. I find a bit... It feels quite formula, like a bit like, yeah, it just feels quite old-fashioned. There's a couple of cops or FBI guys going and interviewing serial killer. It feels a bit like, yeah, it's like, I don't mean that in a negative way, just in a kind of, it doesn't feel like a lot of sort of Netflix-y stuff does now on that kind of modern era TV. It feels kind of
I think it's that crossover after Breaking Bad, but before a lot of other stuff, where it's kind of like, it's older than you, it's not older than you think. It's like four or five years old by now, but it's kind of like, Netflix has exploded in the last 5 years, I think it's like one of those shows where it's before there's like a blueprint of this is how you make a modern TV series. It's kind of like. There's still one foot in, let's do it like they used to do it. And I think it probably lends itself to the show because it's a period. But, yeah, I thought there's a couple of bits that I really like. So you're, like, being a film detective and you're watching it. And there's a bit in the lobby of the cinema. Mm. And they're meant to be in the cinema watching Dirty Harry. And so they show a clip, but it's not a clip with Clint Eastwood in it. Is it Scorpio?
Yeah.
So it's a clip with Scorpio in the cinema, and they're all watching Dirty Harry because Dirty Harry was based on the Zodiac.
Murders. Yeah.
And so the cops have been trying to solve this case for so long that they've all gone to the cinema, and Dirty Harry is out, and Dirty Harry is a movie that's based on the case that they're working on, and Dirty Harry is this no-nonsense cop that's going around solving stuff with a gun, and they're all sat there going, oh, God, why can't we? We think we know who it is, but we've got to go through all this red tape. And they're sat in the cinema, but the footage they're using is not of Clint Eastwood. And then they come out in the lobby, and there's... like Mark Ruffalo, he walks past this marquee stand of Clint Eastwood as Dirty Harry, but the way the camera is angled, they literally just cut his head off, and it's just Dirty Harry's body from the neck down with a gun, and it says Dirty Harry on it, but they go past it, and then there's a poster for Dirty Harry which looks like the famous 1970s poster for Dirty Harry. But they've sort of like photoshopped Clint Eastwood's face out of it. And then you look at it and you kind of like go, Clint Eastwood didn't give them permission to use his face.
Oh, how funny.
And you go, but like you watch it and you can just see the art department at work going like, right, can't use his face. And the way that they, like the fact that they frame the camera so that it just cuts his head off. It's like it could be anyone's body doing a Dirty Harry pose. And they just cut his head. And I just was like, wow, I wonder why he didn't give him permission to use
that,
his...
that does seem weird.
Because it would have cost them loads of money, I guess. And so then it goes like, oh, well, this film was like low budget. And then you've got Mark Ruffalo is in the lobby of the cinema. So he's watching Dirty Harry and he gets so pissed off that he kind of like gets up and he's so frustrated with how his hands are tied. He gets up and he leaves the movie. And then you have Jake Gyllenhaal. You have Jake, Maggie's brother. And he comes out and he sees Mark Ruffalo and he runs over to him in the lobby while the movie's still playing. And he comes over and he chats to him and they meet for the first time. And then a bit later on, Jake Gyllenhaal reintroduces himself to Mark Ruffalo, and he says, "Oh, I met you at the cinema once," and Mark Ruffalo doesn't remember. And you go, "You were watching Dirty Harry, and Mark Ruffalo walked out early because he was so frustrated, and you chatted to him in the lobby while he was." He'll remember that. He'll remember it as soon as you give him any extra details other than, "I bumped into you once at the cinema." And you're just sort of like shouting at the screen, like going, "You've got, like, just say the information that we know." Like, he would remember going to see Dirty Harry. It's a film based on the case that he's been working on. And he'll remember getting so pissed off with it that he had to get up and leave. And you remember that because you were at the cinema and you ran up to him and you found your opportunity to start a conversation with him. I just found that very sort of... So it's not a perfect film, I'd say.
Right. It feels like I will take an opportunity to watch it again because I feel like there will be a point with it, I think, where I'm like, "Oh, I do love it, actually. I do love it." And also a very similar film, Jake Gyllenhaal film, tonally, which came out a similar sort of time, was that Nightcrawler. Did you ever see that?
That's amazing.
It's amazing. And that I got straight away, which is the other one that people seem to talk about, like great Jake Gyllenhaal films. And I got it straight away. I went, love this.
Nightcrawler's legitimately good. We've got to play the song.
Will do.
It's one of those things, though. I don't know, but it's sort of like, I always get sort of like, There's this moment when Jake Gyllenhaal was brand new on the scene, and it was just like, oh God, he's sort of like, he's our age and he's brand new and he's in all of these blockbusters. And you kind of like go, well, God, I mean, this guy, it's sort of like, you know, you go, okay, how do you become kind of a Hollywood icon overnight like that?
Yeah.
And then I watch City Slickers. And he's the little boy. He's Billy Crystal.
Oh yes,
son.
Yeah, he is.
In City Slickers, and you go, oh, he was always famous. Yeah. And then you do like a minor minor Google, and then you go like, oh, Paul Newman taught him how to drive.
Yeah.
And you kind of like go, Paul Newman being one of the most famous drivers in Hollywood, naturally gifted behind the wheel. He, you know, like, in terms of driving, Paul, you don't get much more famous than driving.
And aren't his parents in showbiz as well, I think? And
it's silly, but it just made me feel like, oh, it's all right that I haven't achieved that much. I was like, oh, he was born into it. It's fine.
I did find it weird that he went from being the nerdy kid in Donnie Darko to being sort of heartthrob kind of big star within like a couple of years.
I think everyone was sick in their mouth a bit when they saw the first pictures for Prince of Persia. And they're like, oh, no, what's he done? Right, play a song and then, and then let's keep
That's
talking.
Some more.
Let's keep talking, I guess. We'll just keep talking until the world ends, guys.
Staring up at the United Nations. New York is waiting for me. the shows. Well, I read somewhere, some places never close.
While we waste time on your ghost
coming through the door. Big Apple dreaming on a wooden floor. Skyscrapers and subways and stations staring up at the United
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. Sorry, I was just falling through the air and landing on my computer chair. just in time.
What a lovely flight of fancy.
Yeah, I just went for a little fly around the block and just landed back in time to... host the show with my assistant, Mr. Daniel Metcalf.
I was just about to say, just as we were talking about Jason Statham, funnily enough, I was guested on a podcast last week that was called Unequal Sequel, which is about sequels.
Oh, yeah. I got a feeling that I got a message from them about something. Yeah, go on.
It's fun. It's fun to do. And funnily enough, on that, I was talking about Robert Rodriguez because of Desperado. And it came up talking about Jason Statham. And one of the things that came up was a thing that I remember from the time was that there was a rumor at the time that Jason Statham is the same character in The Transporter as he is in at the end of Collateral.
Well, I don't think it's a rumor. He's dressed up as Frank or whatever he is from Transporter, Frank Transporter. And there's a bit in it's at the end. I think it's at the beginning, isn't it? When there's some sort of Tom Cruise or Jamie Foxx brushes past Jason Statham in an airport. Right. We talked about this last week.
No.
We talked about it. We talked about it either on air or off air.
No, I'd remember, I'm sure. Maybe I'm... But well, isn't there also that thing where Jason Statham... I think he's meant to be the same character in the Fast and the Furious movies as he is in the Italian Job remake as well. I think they've made reference to.
These are films that I've not seen anymore.
No, I haven't.
But I suppose that the Italian Job was... did Italian Job get made after the Fast and the Furious became a hit?
Possibly.
And then they went, oh, what property have we got with cars that we can make that's got name recognition? We'll do the Fast and the Furious. Oh, we'll do the Italian Job. And then it was like, right. And there was a sequel, right? Called what? What's the sequel called? The Brazilian Job.
No, it's meant to happen, but it never happened. It was like, it was one of those things that was in production and then I think never made it.
Oh, right. Yeah, because I thought maybe it was the sequel to a film that I never saw. Like, yeah. I never saw the original, so I didn't have really any interest in watching. I saw the original. I've seen the Italian Job. Sure. Just haven't seen the Italian Job. I'm there working with Ridley. I said, Ridley, what's going on? I've got a bloody insect bursting out of my chest.
R.I.P.
Not a bad one, though. Not bad.
Pretty good. I got it immediately.
Not a bad guest that we've just had.
So yeah.
Popping his head through the door. R.I.P. Ridley. So, anyway, right, so... Right, Jason says it. So, yeah, I believe that he is the transporter in Collateral.
Yeah.
But then I was also sort of like, what if he's Crank?
In what?
In Collateral. I just think, I absolutely bloody love Jason Statham. I think he is great, and I feel like a sense, in a really good way, sense of national pride every time I see him in something.
It's funny that even something like The Meg, which plays almost like, which I guess on paper is quite sort of stereotypical by the numbers, big shark movie, his addition makes it seem like this is all kind of ironic and all a bit like, I know what it is. It all feels like he's doing something. Him being in the cast makes it sort of does escalate the film a bit to being something like, a much better film. Yeah, it's a much better film than you think it is.
Now, the book The Meg is great, right? There's a series of books called The Meg, but the original The Meg starts off in prehistoric times and there's some T-Rexes fighting each other on the beach. And they're fighting on a beach and then a megalodon jumps out of the water and eats a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And it must have been written about the same time as Jurassic Park. So he's read Jurassic Park and he's gone, I'm going to write one of these, but I'm going to just literally, which is weird because in the Spielberg thing, it's like you go, I've got a great white shark, I've got a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And then it goes back to, just a bigger shark then. If I'm going to be, like in Jurassic World, they've got a shark that whatever the... It's not a megalodon, whatever the thing in the water tank in Jurassic World.
Yeah.
It jumps out and it bites a great white shark. And the joke is, you know, that's a great white shark. And it's all sort of Spielbergian because it's like, it's a great white shark from Jaws. And then you've got like the marketing campaign for the Meg where you've got a great white shark from Jaws. And then it's got the megalodon that's about to eat the great white shark from Jaws. And you kind of like go, oh, wow, the megalodon's really huge. The book is just, it starts off like that, and then it's just really like, it's not tongue-in-cheek. It's like really stereotypical macho stuff. Right. We've got like this professor anti-hero who's great with weapons, who's sort of like an expert at the Mariana Trench. And he knows everything. He's the smartest man in the room. He's the tallest man in the room. He can handle his alcohol and he can, you know, punch a man in the face. And it's like he can wear an equally at home in a tuxedo or a swimsuit. It's kind of like, right, sure. So they're sort of like trashy, cheesy sort of books. I hear lots of people saying, oh, yeah, The Meg. When that first trailer for The Meg came out, where it was, they played Somewhere Beyond the Sea. The music Somewhere Beyond the Sea was playing. And then this Jason Statham in this tiny little submarine, one-man submarine. And then the shark goes past him. And he just goes, he's a megalodon.
Yeah.
And you kind of like go, yes, this is the movie. I went to see it with Ramesh and Yasmin from Reluctant Landlord. And while we were filming Reluctant Landlord, really loud playing going outside my window. While we were filming The Reluctant Landlord, the trailer came out and I showed like Ramesh and we were like, oh my God, this looks amazing. We all went to see it. Never really chatted about it after we saw it. It was sort of like one of them films where you kind of like, it's not quite as crazy as what they wanted. It's a very deeply compromised, like being a film detective, as I am now. It's one of those very deeply compromised movies where half the money came from China. And so you have these, as a nation, China has very different sensibilities to America when it comes to like telling stories. And so sort of like Star Wars doesn't really work in China because they don't really do movies involving stories involving ghosts, and ghost stories aren't popular in, which is weird because I do feel like there are Chinese ghost stories, but it's like one of those things where you kind of like go, all right, so things that work here don't work here.
Yeah.
And so when there's a co-production like The Meg was, you've kind of got these two kind of sensibilities that are pulling at each other. John Turteltaub made it and he did the National Treasure movies, which is sort of like Indiana Jones light action adventure kids movies that that could have probably done with being a little bit more gritty, but they're not amazing movies, but they're like these Disney live action.
And what they are, which The Meg is as well, is that they're formulaic in a kind of, it's like, yeah, yeah, I know what that film is.
Right.
You try to mean, you can kind of go, yeah, yeah, I know what the tone is of this film and I know that.
The Meg does have sort of like flourishes where you go, where you can kind of like see a better film in there. But I think the final film is so compromised and ironically toothless that you kind of...
You are totally right, actually. The Meg is that exactly. It's not... It never quite lived up to its own hype.
But I don't want...
Everyone went to see it.
I don't want to be the guy that comes along and says The Meg's rubbish.
No.
Because some people genuinely think The Meg is absolutely incredible. But what I would say is you're lying to yourself because you are seeing the film that you want it to be, right?
Yes, exactly.
That it is.
Did you see he's doing the second one?
Well, Jason Statham was really pissed off because he signed on to a hard R shark, giant shark movie. And then because of all the behind the scenes stuff, it got turned into kind of like a PG-13 Chinese co-pro where it was kind of like, right, well, we're not going to have too much blood and guts and gore, and there's going to, you know, there's a very sincere subplot that's going on where Jason Statham falls in love with a woman and he's got like an ex-wife, and the way that that whole dynamic goes is everyone is absolutely, you know, he's got an ex-wife that's on this underwater rig and he goes down there and he meets this new woman and he has this very sort of like sincere relationship with this new woman, but they sort of play it for laughs. But it's kind of like the way that it comes across is it's just very awkwardly done. And then his ex-wife seems to be absolutely fine with the fact that he's got this, and there's no
conflict.
Conflict whatsoever. There's no conflict in, you know. Everyone seems to be absolutely all right. Even Rainn Wilson, who's the bad guy, is sort of like, he's only a little bit bad.
Yes, yeah.
He's sort of like, he's actually...
He's more of a fool, isn't he? He's kind of a bit of a fool. Like, he's kind of like, he's a bit silly and a bit kind of like, okay, yeah, yeah.
It's odd casting. It's sort of like well, what about Rainn Wilson? And you kind of like go, really? For the main bad guy? Okay, well, and he's good in it. But it's sort of like he's not really a bad guy. He's a bit shady. And then he gets sort of like this death scene and you kind of like go, yeah, but it's sort of like a bit of a disappointing death scene. And they, you know, you see sort of like this bloodless, severed hand, and it's kind of like, oh, right, that's literally, you're pushing it as far as you can go with that.
Mm.
That's like your big death scene, and that's as bad as it gets. And it's kind of like, if you're going to do a film called The Meg, it's got to be like Piranha 3D, right?
Yeah,
it's got to be just like, well, if you're going to put Jason Statham in it, it's got to be absolutely insane, and it wasn't really.
Yeah. The Meg 2 is being done by Ben Wheatley. It's a kind of an interesting choice for... And I think actually that's almost, I guess, retrospectively reflects back on the first one where you go, what a weird choice.
A field in England.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's in the Meg 2, which makes you think, I think, you go, oh, well, great, that'll be mad. But you go, actually, you're right. The first one isn't that mad.
I mean, it's more like Ghost Rider, Ghost Rider 2 than Crank. You know?
Yes, yeah.
It's Crank meets Jaws. You go, yes, absolutely. Even if it's Transporter meets Jaws, you go, oh, wow. But it's not. It's like this, it's like Cool Runnings. Didn't John Turteltaub do Cool Runnings?
I think he did. I think he did.
It's like Cool Runnings meets Jaws. Only it's like really sort of like you leave, it's all family friendly, but it doesn't, it's like, although I like Cool Runnings and The Meg, I just feel like, it's so weird that, I watched another film, Great White. It's just so unbelievably weird that there's Jaws and then there's basically no other good shark movies.
Well, no, but I think what I was about to say was it was interesting that in the light of Jaws, but I think the book Jaws, the Peter Benchley book, more than the film, there were all those kind of airport novels, weren't they? Some of which got adapted into Jaws ripoffs.
Orca.
Off the back of that. Yeah, Orca, The Deep. And some of them came out as like Jaws ripoffs off the back of Jaws. I mean, I think in my head, I was thinking that about
Wasn't The Deep Peter Benchley?
Oh, it's also, yeah, I think that is also Peter Benchley, yeah. Hmm. Yeah. But then I was thinking, oh, yeah, The Meg book, that would have come out a long time after Jaws did. But you're right, it's probably off the back of Jurassic Park rather than Jaws.
I think it's off the back. Yeah, absolutely. It starts with Tyrannosaurus Rex is fighting, and then they go, well, what about a prehistoric shark?
Yeah.
I think it's, yeah, it's a good idea. But, yeah, but in terms of shark movies, there's Jaws, and then probably the, you know, there's Jaws 2, which do you know what? The first half of Jaws 2 is much better than the second half of Jaws 2.
Mm.
The Jaws, you know, when it's just kids on boats, it's kind of like, I don't like these kids. I don't relate to these kids. And it's almost like you, the people that have made this film, have forgotten that the second half of Jaws is three men on a boat getting to know each other. Whereas the second half of Jaws 2 is a bunch of kids that you don't care and you just care about and you're just waiting for them to get eaten by a shark. And it's kind of like, that's the opposite of what Jaws is.
Mm.
You've got all of that stuff in the first half and then it becomes like, and I don't know what the solution to that is. I'm just saying that Jaws is like a perfect film. But what was the one that I watched? The Shallows. That out of all of the shark movies... And I don't mean sort of like Jaws knockoffs. I mean films that have a shark in them.
Mm-hmm.
Great White is awful. 57 feet down or whatever it is, meters down.
What I was thinking The Shallows was.
That's not great, but it's kind of like, it's a nice idea that it's not trying to be Jaws. It's someone in a cage and the cage gets stuck. And then in between them and the boat is... loads of sharks, and it's kind of what do you do? But The Shallows is really tense. It's really kind of like you've got one actress in it, and she's
the one where she just goes overboard and she can't get back on.
No, that is I can't remember what that is. The Shallows is about a surfer, and then she's stuck on like a rock, and she's injured, and she can't get back to the. Beach because the shark's in between her and it's brilliant, like it's tense and all of that stuff, but it's not like I just don't understand. So when you see The Meg and you kind of like go, why is it, you kind of can't do something classy like Jaws.
Mm.
You've got to go like, this is trash, so we're going to make something trashy.
Yeah,
They didn't do it. It's not trashy enough.
And it's that crossover, isn't it, of that time where I guess Jaws is still New Hollywood, so he's still making like Close Encounters is. Spielberg's still kind of making a 70s movie. He's not making the movies that would come off the back of Jaws.
Yeah. So he's making, you've got a bit of spectacle and it's sort of a monster movie, but it's not. And he's not really pushing it. I think he's worrying a little bit he's worrying while he's making Jaws about breaking believability. So he's pushing the limits of what's believable. The size of the shark, etc. But he's sort of like trying to keep it relatively grounded, and then it becomes like a character study, which is a very 70s thing, you know. Whereas, there's no comparison. I just think people are lying to themselves if they think that.
Yeah. Before we get onto fan mail, just want to say quickly that we are now number 79 in Guyana. And 166 in New Zealand.
79 in Guyana and 166 in New Zealand. No word yet as where we are in Malta this week, but no. I think that's all right. I think it's all right. So, I mean, I don't think anyone can be in any doubt that we have delivered another fine example of fan club. I did actually want to talk about The Departed a little bit, but we've run out of time. But I started rewatching The Departed after Zodiac because it's like men in a movie acting in a 3-hour movie.
I think I could be up for that next time because The Departed is one of those films that without meaning to, which is a good sign of a good film, I reckon I've watched 5 or 6 times since it came out.
Oh, I thought it was shit.
Oh, really?
I saw it at the cinema and I loved it. And I was watching it again. I was like, oh, I'm sort of embarrassed that we're watching this now. There's so many bits where you like go, ooh. But we'll talk about that another time.
Let's talk about it another time.
Okay. Here he is. The man, the myth. It's Brian Johnson. Here, Nick, Nathaniel.
George Metcalf.
Natalie, Irene, Brian and Christopher. Brian, that's me. I'm enjoying your show from Marbella. I was thinking, you often talk about food, but not drink. I mean, it's terrible. It's all over the place today, Brian. haven't spoken out loud in a while. What is your favorite drink? I must admit, I'm a big fan of spirits. I don't know.
I don't know if this makes me an alcoholic.
Absolutely. But what do you drink on a night out? Cheers, Philippe. I don't drink anymore, so I drink, at the moment. So I drink Diet Coke on a night out, but my favourite drink is Pepsi Max Cherry.
Well, I've been enjoying recently, after a while of not really having it, an Aspel cider, if it is on tap. I've quite been enjoying an Aspel cider.
It's very sweet, isn't it?
It is very sweet.
Yeah, I do like that.
I do like it.
I do like it. Hello! This is how it's written. Hello, boys! I've just stumbled into your podcast and I love it. I really like the fact that you are charting in a different place every week.
Yeah, we do too. We love that.
I'm currently on holiday in Greece and I'm working really hard to make you chart over here. So I'm telling all my friends.
Well, not really my friends, but all the people I'm meeting in the island I'm at.
I was just wondering if you had any Greek-related film suggestions for me. Thanks, Emily.
Shirley Valentine, is that in Greece or is that in...
There's is it called Dogtooth? The guy that's the Yorgos Lanthimos who did The Favourite. That film, Dogtooth, is very funny and weird. But it's well worth your time. I'm pretty sure that is made in Greece.
And also, obviously, My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick and Nat! I recently...
And obviously Jason and the Argonauts.
Hey, Nick and Nat! I recently finished watching Gary Gennetti, The Prince. What a waste of a talented cast. How did any of them agree to take part in this? Michael.
I don't know what any of that is.
I don't know what any of that is, Gary, Michael. But you seem to have missed the point of fan club. Here we talk about stuff that we like.
Yeah. Actually, can I change my answer to Jason and the Argonauts?
Sure.
Cheers.
Imagine Jason Statham and the Arkanauts.
Yeah, I've just been told that Shirley Valentine is set in Greece. So that's
it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, yeah, I thought it was. Yeah. So so imagine Shirley Valentine and the Argonauts. She goes out there to sort of get over her husband.
Yeah.
And she ends up fighting skeletons and a Gorgon. I'm getting them mixed up. It's not Clash of the Titans, is it? Jason and the Argonauts is the skeletons.
Clash of the Titans.
It's the Gorgon Medusa.
Yeah. Harry Hamlin, isn't it? Harry Hamlin, Clash of the Titans.
Yeah.
There you go. Should we play a song?
I mean, this is a lackluster. The energy is well done.
No, but we were on it for a second. We've just let it go.
We were. Yeah. You're wearing a Colour of Money t-shirt.
Well, it's sort of, yeah, because my friend John Charno, who's a cartoonist, Britain's most isolated cartoonist, goes by the name on Twitch of Newman Cruz and on social media, and that's his t-shirt that he does because he's a massive fan of Colour of Money.
I thought it was the first Newman I thought of was Rob Newman.
I thought it was going to be Badil underneath.
Well, no, I thought, what's Rob Newman doing with Tom Cruise? And then I was like, oh, it's fine. Probably went for a chicken tikka in wherever Tom Cruise is filming at the moment. All right, great. We'll play a song and then we'll get our guest on.
He's here.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back! We're back, guys! Whoa! And here we are. We are hitting the ground running. And we're back live. We're not live, we're pre-recorded. I'm in my office. It's really like an office. I've really done a really good job with that. And Nathaniel is in his bare bones washroom. And we're joined now by our guest, stand-up comedian Steen Raskopoulos. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm very well, thank you. And lovely washroom, Nathaniel.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh. Well, you've got tons of books. You're impressing me with your wide reading.
Nathaniel, it's just all props. Nathaniel, all props.
Anyone can buy a book.
Okay.
I've got tons of books in this room. I just decide not to put them directly behind me, you know.
Right.
So there you go. But what you do have, Steen, is you've got this wonderful picture of a greyhound. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so. It's not mine. I'm in my partner's study. So this looks much more fancy than what I wanted it to be.
Are these your partner's books?
Yeah. I think I've got two of them up there somewhere, but it's amongst the clutter now.
Oh, well, never mind. Well, let's make the best out of this and we'll rattle through. So, Steve, you're doing your show at the Soho Theatre, aren't you? That's coming up.
Yeah, that's right, in 2 weeks. It's a show that I wrote in hotel quarantine when I went back to Australia earlier this year. I thought, what better way to use my time in isolation than writing a comedy show?
And how long was that? Was that 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yep. The first draft was mostly just characters crying in the shower, wanting to be let out, and then kind of had to adjust and realise that wasn't for everybody.
That's interesting, that period, though, because I think of, like, writing... show for me takes about 4 months.
Yeah.
But that 4 months is probably a lot of procrastination and not actually doing it. But I actually find it quite impressive that I suppose actually if I did sit down for 2 weeks and I couldn't leave or do anything, maybe I could do it in 2 weeks.
Yeah. And I think because it's my first show in like 3 years as well. So similar to you, I've been procrastinating for 3 years whether to do another show. And then I was called 1 week before I went to Australia by the Sydney Comedy Festival directors, like, hey, you should do a show. I was like, yeah, fair enough. And then that's how it all kind of amalgamated.
I think sometimes that's for the best. I did in 2013, I did a show that I wasn't going to do up until about January, February, March, but until about April, I'd done sort of like a pilot for something and I'd done a radio show. And I'd felt like I'd done, in the first couple of months of that year, I'd done all of the work that I had to do that year in a very concentrated amount of time so that I could do some other stuff later on. And then they were like, no, you've got to do Edinburgh. And so I wrote a show in a short amount of time. And it was like, oh, right. And it was a great show with some of my best songs and stuff. But like, sometimes... you know, when your brain gets sort of like taken by surprise like that, you end up creating something incredible.
I think so. And I think with deadlines as well, I'm definitely a person who, if I have a deadline, I write to it. But if I don't, then I will not do anything until I'm told otherwise.
Absolutely. There's been a couple of instances over the last year where I've had to write a song for a thing and I've managed to like write the lyrics and produce it and get the song done. And I can do it for the thing. But in terms of an album, I've got an album that I haven't done for 4 years that's waiting to be finished. And it's kind of, I love deadlines. It's been difficult without them, like traditionally, I suppose.
Yeah. That's why I like school to some degree, because you got in trouble if you didn't do the work. Or at uni, I was so surprised when I attended university for the first time. Like, if you guys don't do it, you fail. And it's like, what? Yeah, you just fail. We don't care. We're not going to grade. You're just going to fail. Yeah. And then you have to do the subject again.
And you don't have to turn up, really. No one's keeping a register. It's just like, you don't have to come in. No,
for the first few weeks, I was like dressed in like a college shirt thinking everyone's rocking up in like flip-flops and things. I'm like, what? You don't have to. Oh, this is great.
So how did you feel about that 2 week deadline? Were you fairly like, yeah, I can do that? Because I think if someone gave me a 2 week deadline for a show, I'd have a meltdown. I don't think I could handle it.
It wasn't until like 2 weeks. So like the shows were 4 weeks after I got out, but I had like a friend's wedding. I had like people to catch up with. And at the time in Australia, in Sydney, where I'm from, like there was zero COVID, like generally zero COVID. So I could go and do everything and anything. And then when there was a week to go before I was doing the shows, I was like, why am I doing a show when I can literally do anything at any time?
Okay, so I feel like I've jumped into the middle of a conversation right now. So let's start at the beginning of the story. Your show is on at the Soho Theatre. It's called business.never.stops. And it's from Thursday the 9th to Saturday, September the 11th at 9:30 p.m. at Soho Theatre, right? So lockdown. You are an Australian comedian.
Yes.
Who lives in England.
Correct.
And you went back to Australia at the beginning of lockdown.
Yep.
And you were in isolation for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of that, the Sydney Festival said, would you like to do an Edinburgh show? would you like to do a show at the festival? And you went, fuck it, yes, I'll do that.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
So your first lockdown in Australia was 2 weeks.
No, so like when you arrive in Australia, you have to do a mandatory 2-week hotel quarantine.
Yeah. Oh, you have to do that. You have to do that in France and stuff and Europe. Yeah, right. Okay, right.
Yeah, but so when you get off the plane, you are escorted by the federal police and the army, and you don't have a say where you're going. It's a lottery pick. And
wow.
And they put your bags on a bus, and they tell you to sit down. And then you're left on the bus. Well, this is my experience. I was left on the bus for 40 minutes. Then someone from the army comes on and going, is anyone a VIP here? And everyone's looking around going like, well, what's a VIP? Like I've done like a couple of shows and like, so you're looking around and then they leave. Then everyone's like, well, what's going on? Who's the VIP? And half an hour later, someone goes, are you sure no one's a VIP? I'm looking around and like, man, do I put my hand up? Am I going to be that guy? And then they're like, is anyone called like Mr. Helms here? I'm like, Ed Helms? From Hangover, where are you? And then they're like, no, okay. And then the army get off. 5 minutes later, bus driver gets on. Then they tap the side of the bus and it just starts driving. And you're like, okay. And everyone's going, hey, Mr. Bus Driver, you know, what hotel are we staying at? And he just like did not look back whatsoever, just kept his eyes on the road, didn't speak. And then after 40 minutes, yeah, pulled up to the hotel. Then the army gets you bagged off the bus and they lock you in a room for 2 weeks.
Did you know that getting on the plane, or is this sort of like when you land, this is sort of like news or what?
No, knew that was what was going to happen when you get on the plane, but didn't know in terms of the procedure or what hotel, because like some of my friends had done it and they got some absolute garbage hotels and the food was horrible and really bad experiences. And other friends were like, it's probably the best 2-week hotel stay I've ever had in my life. So just a luck of the draw. And luckily I did get a good hotel.
Oh, yeah. It's a little bit like when you land abroad and it's like 4 o'clock in the morning and then you get on a bus and you don't really know what's going on. And you don't speak the language and lots of other families are getting off the bus and your family is the last family on the bus. And you're like going, maybe we should have got off earlier. And it's all very confusing and scary. And then you have a fortnight in paradise, yeah, in the Algarve.
And I'm not a big sports person, Steen, so you'll have to forgive me. But there was some sort of tennis tournament in Australia last year. It was a big one, and apparently when they got there was loads of people quarantining, but the hotel that a lot of the kind of professional tennis players are in, it was like mouse infested. And I've got a fear of mice, and the idea of being locked in a hotel room that you can't even leave, that have got mice running around in, was my nightmare.
That turned out to be a Japanese game show that they sold. No, I think that was definitely a thing. And I think it was during the Australian Open and players were like really upset and they turned their mattresses on the side and they were hitting the balls against the mattresses. And like Novak Djokovic came out and said, no, we should all be given an 8-bedroom, a house with 2 tennis courts, just because they're around everywhere in Australia. but it was a thing, as you said, Nick, like you knew when you arrived, like you had to do it. And no one was exempt, which I thought was quite good.
Apart from this Helms cat, apparently, whoever he was.
It wasn't me with an ass. I'm not VIP. I suppose it depends if they listen to Fan Club or not. What did it feel like, though? Did it feel like the future? Did it feel like we're in, like, a dystopian future? And it reminds me of, is it the beginning of Escape from L.A., when the police get involved and they start turfing everyone out of Los Angeles so they can turn it into a prison? Did it feel exactly like that, Steen?
Exactly like that. I thought, man, I'm in this movie. It was weird because I think in England at the time, everything was still in lockdown. And then once you're on the bus and you just saw people outside of pubs smoking and having drinks, and then people at restaurants and in shopping centres, it was that kind of, this is weird. And then, being in the hotel room, you get served three meals a day and someone knocked on the door and just left it there. But I never saw the person. And there'd be times you're like, thank you. And then from a very far distant away, like, you're welcome. So it felt like this mythical kind of person kept dropping off the food all the time, but you never saw them.
That's a bit like Old Boy when he's like in a room and then meals just arrive. And that's we've all lived through it, but it's sort of exciting, isn't it?
Yeah. And I just assume that you don't get given a key and they kind of lock you in. So you can open the door to get the food, but there's security guards and the federal police strolling the hallway so you don't actually leave your room, which is kind of like a prison.
Yeah.
But it was just because I was still in a hotel, I they gave me like 4 or 5 towels and I thought, oh, that should last me for 2 weeks. And then my it just started smelling like the room. I'm like, oh, I wish someone would come clean it. And then I called and I asked for more sheets and towels. Like, oh, yeah, we can absolutely do that for you. I should also say, I didn't have an open window with fresh air for 2 weeks. And I thought my air conditioning was broken for the full 2 weeks because I tried to turn it on when I arrived. It didn't work. And then on the last day when I was let out, I was like, oh, I may as well just hit power, and it turned on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was not happy.
Do you know, I didn't have the internet for 5 months during the first, during last year, 2020. I didn't have Sky TV, because I'm with Sky. I didn't have Sky TV, I didn't have any TV. I can't remember how I was surviving. I think I was just DVDs and
you're going through your boxes of DVDs, weren't you?
Yeah, right. Okay. And then it was literally just like, I just had to reset the box. And it was a 3-minute job, and it went on for 5 months. 5 months. So I'm a cunt just like you, mate. Okay, right. So this is that's when you wrote your show.
Yeah.
Now, that's really interesting because a lot of people have written stuff during the pandemic and during lockdown, and I think that as comedians, we've all sort of like been discussing, or at least thinking about, what sort of show we want to write when we get back from this. Is it going to be a show that's all about lockdown? Is it going to be a show about the pandemic? Is it going to be what is it? Is it going to be a show that we'd been writing before? Are we just going to pick up where we left off? I don't think anybody
and also,
really...
Like, what do audiences want?
What do audiences want? Do we want 3,000 up in Edinburgh? Do we want 3,000 shows all about the pandemic? And I've been like, no, absolutely not. And so I've been kind of like writing stuff to... I just think it's a really interesting thing that we all have to do. But when you went there, it was right at the start. It was just 2 weeks. So it's not like you're writing a show about your pandemic experience. It's like, right, well, I'm going to write a show. It's kind of like almost like a unique kind of approach, right?
And it was nice because at that time, Sydney hadn't even experienced a lockdown. So if I came here going, you guys know what it's like to be, you know, stuck in your houses for months. Like they didn't.
Yeah.
And also I think so many people were going to do and tell those jokes and stories, and I don't think I would have done anything better than them. So I kind of just left it, and my show has nothing to do with the pandemic. It's got nothing to do with anything that's taken place. It's just, yeah.
And how does that play? Do people like go, well, hang on a minute, what about the pandemic? Or do people, do you know what I mean? It's like kind of, it happened to everyone, so do we even need to mention it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you have to mention it. I do say that I watched a lot of, TV and movies like everyone else did during that time. And it kind of like I really got into Scandinavian detective kind of series. And in my show, I do like a three-runner of like a Scandi kind of cop where I get a member for the audience to play like my detective. But even then, like, because I do so much, or have done so much audience participation in the past, that was a challenge for me. Like, well, how can I do it that's safe and that people would feel comfortable coming up to do, knowing I can't be too close to them, or, you know, them kind of speaking, or, you know, some people have different vibes, and I guess still do, especially in London, coming out to theatre again, even though it's open. So it's just, yeah, figuring out a way for people to feel comfortable with that.
The other thing that strikes me about sitting in a hotel room and writing a show for 2 weeks is that I probably, when I write shows, I would never sit down in a room and write it for 2 weeks, and then when I finished it, get up on stage and try it. I would literally, if I've got a preview in the evening, I'll make some notes, and I'll go through all of the notes that, because I make notes all the time.
Mm.
And I'll go through all of the notes and all the ones that are worth saying. And then I'll kind of, I won't write anything, but I'll go on stage and I'll try out all of the notes. Because there'll be things, a note that is relating to something that has happened, or an idea that I have had that I've written it in my head already. So I just need a little note to jog my memory to be able to say what it is I'm going to say. And that's how I'll write it. And then I'll say it enough times on stage that it becomes a thing. And then that's how I do it. So if I was to sit down in a room for 2 weeks and write a show, I could do that. I think I would enjoy that, but it'd be a completely different process without testing material every night as I wrote it. So how was it for you?
I did one, not even a preview. I did one kind of, gave away like 30 kind of free tickets to do a small kind of taster of as exactly as you said, just no narrative or arc, or, you know, everything is out of order. Essentially, like just a jigsaw puzzle to see like if any of the puzzles kind of fit in the thing I was trying to make. And then opening night was the first time I did it in front of pretty much anyone. But I guess, I don't know. I think coming here, you do so many previews and testing out ideas kind of thing, where I think back home, you kind of run it in at festivals. And by the time Sydney Comedy Festival comes around, I would have done the show maybe 30, 40 times at like Brisbane and Melbourne. So when it hit Sydney, it's kind of pretty much ready, where this was the opposite, where I started at the very, very, very beginning at Sydney, and which is always so scary because like that's my hometown. That's where I get my biggest audiences from. So to do an opening night in front of, you know, 550 people is not the way I would have liked to have done it.
And are you hitting the ground running? Or I think part of the problem over here was like Edinburgh used to be like a much smaller affair where comedians would scrape together whatever material, they'd go out and they'd do it for a month, and then by the end of it they'd have a show that they could tour. And now it's like you get reviewed on day one. So whereas Edinburgh was like you have a month of previews basically, and then by the end of it you've got a show.
Yeah.
It's like you've got to have a show, so you've got to do the equivalent of an Edinburgh festival before you go out to Edinburgh. Well, I've never done any of the Australian festivals. I'm scared of travelling and spiders. So what's sort of like the vibe? Is it a little bit more kind of not work in progress, but like is it a little bit more kind of like you're putting the show together? It's a brand new show, or are people expecting something finished and polished?
It depends which festival. I think with Melbourne and Sydney, like Melbourne especially, would be the closest comparison to Edinburgh. So Melbourne's like where you want to do your show kind of fully polished. So that's what's funny, when the international acts come to Melbourne, they're taking the Edinburgh show from the previous year, so they're super polished, ready to go. Where Melbourne, for the Australian acts, I would say it's the first 4 or 5 shows that you're definitely like trying to run into, figure out, and they're all preview kind of low ticket prices. But by the second week, like it needs to be quite polished, because that's how everyone approaches it. So you don't want to be, you know, the person a bit lagged behind and, you know, hit your straps in the last week. You've got to try and get that word of mouth and that buzz in that second week for people to
come. I think that's a much better system, because even in Edinburgh, however many previews you've done, like I find I don't really have a show until about day 4 or 5.
Absolutely.
It's still like, I'm still like going, you know, something like this, and I'm getting used to a new room. I haven't been previewing in a room in Edinburgh. It's a whole new I'm dealing with whatever's happening.
Absolutely.
If there's a loud show next door or whatever.
Then you mentioned that. And like the shape of the room, not just like the size of the room, but the shape of the room completely. When I did Keep Hold of the Gold in 2010, I was at the Tron, downstairs at the Tron. That room completely dictated what the show was. I didn't have a show on when I did the tech get in. I didn't have a show. Like, I did loads of previews. My voice was going. So I basically cancelled the last week of previews, didn't have a show. I went up and went, fuck it, I'm not doing Edinburgh again anyway. And then when I got in the room, the show came together. And that show changed my life. But, like, it was just being up there in the experience. I think it's like, doing the previews is kind of like you're shopping for, like, shorts and Bermuda shirts. And do you know what I mean? You're doing all of, like, your holiday shopping. Sure. And then you go up to Edinburgh and you pack your bags. And then, like, the first few days of doing Edinburgh is, like, unpacking all your bags and seeing what you got. And then you kind of, like, put it together for the show. Mm. I love that. I love that whole experience of doing a show. I wrote theatre for years, which was sitting on your own in a room, writing an hour of theatre, and then going out and seeing, after months, what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah,
and I kind of guess, like, my approach to comedy is, like, I don't want to do that. I want to do it like this. Hmm. That's not a question.
No, I agree with your statement. That was very similar to my first Edinburgh. I did a show called I'm Wearing Two Suits Because I'm in Business. And in the show, I wore two suits, but I didn't know what venue I was. Like, I got told it was a 70-seater before I arrived. And then it was like this, what do you call it? It was like a sweat box, a 70-seater sweat box called the Wiku in Underbelly.
Right.
And I could not have chosen a hotter room under those lights to do that show.
A worse room to wear two suits.
Yeah, oh, right. My Lord. And then it became exactly as you said, like, it became part of the show because it was so close with everyone and there was, like, audience participation. Everyone could see how much I was working and sweating. It became part of it. And then after every show, it turned, like, how much kind of milliliters of water can I wring into a bin?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I always say that most comedians try and make you see how easy it is. You know, they try and show you kind of like, look how seamless this comedy is that I'm doing. And I'm like the opposite, and I want everyone to see exactly how hard it is and how hard I'm working. And when you're in one of them little sweat boxes and you're just sweating all over the audience, and at the end you're wringing your shirt out, and it's just like, look, I've done this for you. I want you to know. I want you to feel guilty. On your way out, I want you to feel bad at how hard I've worked for you. And I want you to appreciate it. Do you know what I mean? I love that. That's part of it.
Oh, for sure. And also, like, the tech safety things beforehand, like in Melbourne, pretty much every venue is, like, air conditioned and the lights are, you know, way above your head. And it's all, you know, there's various different, you know, fire procedures, like this exit. And Edinburgh is like, hey, you can't walk here because you're going to crack your head on this light. This socket doesn't work. Don't plug this into here. Leave it to the tech. There's one way to get out. You have to wait for the audience to get out before you're allowed to leave. And just, like, but it's part of it. Like, it's exciting. It feels like everyone's in it together, where I feel like Melbourne and a lot of the other festivals, and, like, no disrespect, but it feels like it doesn't have that you know, that vibe. That,
well, I guess you're very rarely actually performing in a theatre space in Edinburgh, right? You're performing in something that was something else a week before Edinburgh that they've gone, you could kind of make that into a theatre space if you put chairs in it.
If it's got a roof, and not always if it's got a roof, but if it's got a roof, it's a venue. I always think, as an audience member going to see stuff at Edinburgh, not that we have to talk about Edinburgh, but it's on at the moment, or it would be, or it is. I don't know what's happening. But, you know, when you're little and you go and see Santa Claus, and it's at like a store, and you're going around all of these corners, and you're queuing for ages, and then you finally go around the corner and it's this little room and there's a guy just up Santa Claus and you've not seen him before, and you kind of like go, oh, wow. That's kind of like what Edinburgh is. It's kind of like you don't know. It's like everyone's sort of like up for an adventure. Mm. And it's kind of like, oh, well, I guess this is the venue. And I guess this person's going to come out and make the best out of this terrible situation we've all found ourselves in. Yeah. And I love that. I love it.
And also, it's like, hey, I spoke to that guy on the street, had me fly, and he's wearing a suit, and now he's naked.
Now he's
covering himself in Cheetos.
Now he's wearing two suits.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had this idea where you're kind of like going to wear two suits, and then the venue's hot, and then it sort of informs the way that the show's going to go.
For sure. And then it's like, I need to find a dry cleaner because like I have to share this dressing room with so many other people, and my suit's going to absolutely reek. So I ended up just buying like heaps of white t-shirts to wear underneath so I could, you know, try and get as much airspace as I possibly could. But the end of the show is everyone on stage dancing over my corpse. So it's a fun way to kind of go.
So, but that's not this show, is it?
No, that's not this show. No.
So what's this show? So what's this show not about? It's difficult because as a comedian, you know what questions you don't really want.
Why?
But what did you end up writing about? If you're in between, aren't you? You're in between real life and locked up life.
Yeah. I think the best way to describe it is because my last show was quite personal and intense. I just wanted to make a really fun show with like sticking to what I know to do, and that's like character and improv and audience participation, and everything's kind of linked in terms of a narrative element. So I think that's what I've tried to go back to. And yeah, from the three shows I did in Sydney, everyone seemed to enjoy it, I think. And yeah, it's only gotten obviously better since I've had more time with it and to rewrite and to perform it. And yeah, and there's a few cheeky cameos from people, but yeah, it should be. No, I'm really excited to perform it again, to be fair.
And if you know you have these improv skills, is that something you know you can lean on, knowing you've got a show you've got to prepare in 2 weeks? I'm obsessed about this 2 week period. I'm just trying to put myself in the headspace of going, this would terrify me. Is that something in your head you go, oh, I can lean on that? Or do you also, it also sounds that you try and put limits on what you do, right?
Yeah.
So you're definitely kind of saying, like you said, I do improv, but I also do a lot of audience participation, but I can't do that this time. Therefore, I have to come up with something else. So there are all these different limitations every show, right, that you're having to like impose on yourself or that the world's imposing on you.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's a thing of like, I still do audience participation in the show, but, you know, stuff where I'd probably, you know, drink water and spit on people. I can't do that anymore. Not that I did originally, but you know, you just have to be a bit more health conscious, I guess, and make it fun for them to feel safe getting up. But with the improv element, it's you can never, like, no matter how many times you think of a situation in terms of how it's going to go, someone will always surprise you. Like in terms of how I construct a character, a sketch, or hey, this is going to be the button, and the audience could take it this way, this way, this way, this way. And I think I've genuinely like 100 different ways. Usually, like the first or second show, someone will do something I completely didn't even think about. And you're like, fuck. And that's what I guess fun, because it's the audience kind of doing it for the first time, and they have no idea you've put them under the pump, and then kind of coming up with a way. And that's a bit more challenging, I think. And that's where, yeah, I like to sit in that space of that. Not sure how this is going to go, but hopefully we'll find something.
I used to do quite a lot of audience participation, and then as the shows went on, that was like the element that I kind of like phased out a little bit, because it was just like, it's like one of those things where it's just like, what new thing can I do with the audience? Because it's not a show that's all about, I've got like songs to fit in and routines to fit in and jokes and poems and stuff like that, and then audience participation. And then it's kind of like you want to have it in a controlled environment where you kind of like go, this is the structure to the audience thing. But also it's not so structured that you're feeding them lines. And so it's sort of, I don't know, it was like one of the most difficult parts to include, because I felt like I'd sort of like was repeating myself after a few shows. But it's also one of like the most enjoyable bits, because you go, I've got 5 minutes allocated to audience participation for this bit, and anything can happen within that 5 minutes. But it's structured so that you can get back into the show. But it's kind of like, for you, it's like in this long run, you know, if you're doing kind of like show every day for a month or whatever, it's kind of like this little moment in the show where it's kind of like, oh, this is fun for everyone, because nobody really knows what's going to happen with this.
Yeah, it's, definitely.
I love sort of like the freedom of audience participation, but it is really difficult. I'm not going to say where do you get your ideas from. That's that's a terrible thing. But where do you get your ideas?
I think it's always that thing of I've always had like an idea that, you know, I'm the opposite. If I saw myself performing, I would hate it, because I hate audience participation being
an audience member.
I hate it, but I love kind of doing it with people. But I'm never a bully. Like, I always try and make the person the star of the scene. Like, if there's ever a joke to be had, it's always on me. I'm not a comic to come out and like rip into someone or give them shit, because I don't know.
Down, yeah.
Because I don't know, what they've had, like, you know, they're coming to a show. I don't know what they've been through, what's going on in their life. And also they're paying me money to, you know, try and have a bit of fun for an hour. So with my stuff, I think people over the years have become more, not excited to get on stage, but probably more comfortable, because they know that it's going to be hopefully it will be like a fun experience. It's not going to be something that will embarrass them or anything like that.
You kind of, when you do it right, it's like they end up being the star, the star of the show. But like, they're the guy, at the end of, I was picked on. I always avoid the word picked on. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't see it like that. It's like you're asking them to participate to help you do the show a little bit, you know? Mm. And so at the end, when they're at the bar, they're the person that people go, wow, do you want a pint?
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It's like, I always think of it like that. You're kind of like making a star out of someone for that show.
Oh, for sure. And like, I think the biggest compliment you can get is like, oh, how good was that plant? You're like, absolutely not. You can come every night and always be a different person. Like, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. But you told them to do this, or you told them to say that, and they're like, no, absolutely not. Like, they did and made up their own. And like, why am I fucking talking to you? I'm gonna go talk to the star of the show. You want a pint, mate? You're like, oh, man.
Do you have, I suppose this is probably true for both of you, do you have someone, when you're trying to pick someone out of an audience, is there like a weird rule, like that person is too keen, that person is not keen, that person is about the right level of keen?
Too keen drama kid, shut it down straight away.
Ruins it, yeah. And oh, they try, God. And sorry, you're the guest.
The question was asked to both of us.
I know, but I just always do that. I always like talk about, well, I do comedy too, and it annoys me when I think about it. I'm going to cringe afterwards. But like, if they're too keen, then they ruin it, right?
Yeah, I think it just flips the mood in the audience, because the audience is like, why are you trying to like show off, or why are you trying to do the thing he's not telling you to do or helping you out? And it really fucks with the mood of the show. Well, I found, and then you kind of had to, you know, kind of get them off stage quicker than you anticipated. And it just kind of brings the energy down a bit as well. And people are more upset. Like, they keep looking over to the person who fucked the show rather than, you know, the next sketch or the next kind of character.
And if people think they're the plant, then it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's like, why'd you get that guy?
Yeah.
Awful.
But then also they can be too keen in a way that's kind of like they're, because ideally you want them to work with you.
Mm.
And sometimes you get people that are keen that are too eager to help. And sometimes you get people that are keen that are just there because they want to give it back to you. And you're like, I'm not having a go at you. I'm literally, if you do what I'm sort of guiding you through, then you're going to be a hero. But if you don't, if you kind of like try and second guess me the whole time and try and sort of like challenge me, then it's kind of like, that's not what it's about. Do you know what I mean?
100%.
I had to get someone out in the audience in a show, and it was quite a large venue. I did two nights there, and it was quite a large venue. And on the second night, I went over to a corner of the audience and I got someone out. And they came on stage and they were just sort of like fucking up everything. But like in a really kind of like, I think I know what's going on here kind of way. And they fucked up everything. And it turned out that they were a reviewer.
No.
And when I came up to them, they hid their notepad so that I didn't know that they were a reviewer. And then they pretended that they were just a regular audience member, came up on stage and then wrote a review about how they got one over on me. And it's like, well, you ruined that bit, because normally nobody liked that bit. I didn't enjoy it. You didn't enjoy it. The audience didn't enjoy it. And normally, when you're not overthinking it and you're just going along with it, everyone loves it. I love it. You love it. The audience loves it. You're a hero. You get as many drinks as you can drink for the rest of your life based on how well this bit goes. I think that's that. But, and then also you go the opposite way where someone's got their arms folded and they're not enjoying it. And what happens then? I'm sort of sharing our shared experience.
Well, sometimes those people who do not look interested whatsoever, or you just assume they're not enjoying the show because they have their arms crossed, absolutely smash it. One of my favorite things I ever did was in Edinburgh 2017, I think. And I used to do this sketch, was an office Christmas party. So I used to bring an audience member on stage as the CEO and just say how disgraceful they were during the office Christmas party. And we've had some complaints from your fellow employees, so I endowed the audience. And I just want you just listen to hear what they have to say. And I'd go into the audience and I'd just get all these different offers, what happened to the...
That's amazing.
That's amazing. And it's he shat in the office pot plant. He vomited an ear. He didn't wash his hands in the bathroom. And you get every night, you get an array of different kind of things. And then you'd come back and I'd always say, I want you to think about your choices. And I can't remember how I used to set up, but I want you to watch how poorly you behaved whilst I show you through interpretive dance. And then an orchestral kind of I think it was Gravity by Sarah Bareilles played. And I used to do how they were at the office Christmas party, through interpretive dance and do everything the audience member said. And then I used to sit them back down afterwards and I want you to think about your choices. So if you could do it all over again, you wouldn't shit in the thing, you wouldn't do this, you wouldn't drink, you would wash your hands, all kind of stuff. And I'd say, have 10 seconds to think about it. Then afterwards, you thought about it? Good. And I say, so show me through interpretive dance how you would not have done those things. So they just, it's a call and response to what I did. And the time when people, as you said, the people who are too keen just wouldn't do it. They just keep doing exactly what I did. Listen and do it again.
They've written their own jokes while you're talking.
Yeah. And everyone just goes crazy because as long as you do some form of something, then the audience goes crazy for it. But there was one show in particular when you're talking about the guy with the cross arms. It was this 45-year-old guy, cross arms, didn't look interested the whole show. And I kind of went, fuck it. I don't know if the show was going well or not, but I was like, fuck it, we'll get him up. And the whole time he was just kind of listening to me, watch me kind of thing. And then when I taught him interpretive dance, he unfolded his arms, stood up, slowly unbuttoned the top two buttons of his shirt. And I shit you not, afterwards I spoke to him because it was the best dance. He used to be a former classical dancer and ballerina. And it was just it was just one of those Edinburgh moments that was just the highlight of anything I'll ever do. And I'll never be beaten. The guy had the most flexibility I've ever seen. The emotion he was bringing. It was just he got a standing ovation, right? I couldn't have done anything better. And it was one of those nights, Nick, where people he was 100% a plan. That couldn't couldn't have happened.
Well, I mean, there's a show called One Man, Two Governors over here, which I think James Corden was in, and then it's had loads of other people being the leads. And there's this bit in it where he's on stage. And it's in between scenes. And while he's on stage, he notices there's someone in the audience and they're eating a sandwich. And they're eating a sandwich. And he starts talking to this guy in the audience that's eating a sandwich. And then it turns out that the sandwich is hummus. And the audience are they're losing their mind. The whole audience is losing their mind. And this guy's eating a hummus sandwich. And then it goes up a level. And we're going, oh, my God, that's great. And he rinses this guy in the audience and he takes his sandwich off him and does all this stuff. And then in the interval, the guy doesn't come back and there's an empty seat and you go, well, he's a plant, right? And they do it every night like clockwork and it's the set, it's scripted. Uh-huh. And the audience love it. And then the guy's not back. And it's kind of it's the sort of thing that you can't risk in a West End show. I think it's like this 20-minute section, which is meant to feel improvised. And then afterwards, you kind of realise that it wasn't improvised. And they do something similar in the second half. And then they all come up at the end and they all take a bow. And you're kind of like, you're not even pretending that it was real, you know?
Oh, the hummus guy comes on stage.
Yeah.
I can't remember if the hummus guy comes on stage, but certainly the woman from the second half of the show, she comes on stage and takes a bow. And I felt like really cheated by it because I was doing stand-up and audience participation at that point. And I said, part of the skill of audience participation and part of the skill of stand-up is making it feel like it's new and fresh and is happening for the first time. Actually, stand-up is a script that you're kind of like making it feel like it's the first time you thought of it. But audience participation is going with the flow and letting the audience member sort of dictate a little bit. And that's what keeps it fresh and exciting. And that's what makes it interesting. When you script it and you fake it, it's sort of, what is the fucking point? You might as well not have it. It's a waste of everyone's time.
I saw that same show and I had exactly the same reaction to it because it just felt so hollow and like, oh, well, and I think to the audience, it was a bit like, it was like a magic trick reveal, like, oh, that's how he did it. And it's like, no, but people do this all the time really well. And also,
if you're going to script a bit, script it really good. Don't just make it feel sort of like, oh, it's good for improv. It's good for something that's happening spontaneous, which is the only reason why people like it. When it's fake and everyone knows it's fake, it's kind of like, you may as well have just saved us all 20 minutes and not bothered doing that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think at the end of the show, like, I always enjoy when people have seen me maybe on a Thursday night and they speak to the friends on a Saturday night and they're like, oh, how, since always.
What was your guy like?
Yeah. And it's like, what? We had a girl on this night, or this person did this, or the offers were this. They're like, oh, what? It changes every night. And I think that's why, like, you get a bit of like a repeat audience to see if it is a plan or what's going to happen this night. Or
and then you get like, the person tonight wasn't as good as the person the first time I saw it, or the person tonight was absolutely incredible. You know, it's great. And when you talk about Edinburgh moment or like Fringe moment or doing like a festival, it's like those are the things that you can do. You can go on and you can try and change people's lives by all of the jokes that you've written and, you know, making it into kind of like, it's a one person show. You're on stage. This is your show. You're presenting a show to an audience. They will pay. Their lives will be unrecognizable by the end of the hour and then they will leave. There are tools that you can use to kind of give people a good time. And when you're up in Edinburgh or a festival and you can use the audience and you're in this opportunity to kind of like bring people up and sort of champion them and take a little bit of the pressure off of you, you're making like once in a lifetime experiences for everyone in that room. It's so not like to be like egomaniacal about it, but like it's really sort of like that's what's exciting about doing those festivals as opposed to doing something like One Man, Two Governors, where you don't have the wiggle room to risk it.
Yeah, for sure. And also, like, it does put the pressure on you of, like, you have to turn up. Like, if you're not giving it and being positive and kind of enticing them to play, if you're, you know, too hungover, like, whatever it is, like, it's on you if it fucks up. It's not necessarily on them unless you do choose a drama student kid who just, you know, failed all these acting auditions and has come to try and chance it in your show, which I've had too many of those as well.
Or they're part of like a theatre company that are doing their own show, and then
they unzip their hoodie when they come on and take it off, and it's their promo t-shirt.
Yeah,
and they keep turning the back to the audience the whole time, so it just gives it a dates and website. And,
yeah, I mean,
I just imagine there's someone there with a notebook going, "What is it? Where? There's no one doing it. No one doing it."
Man, I had someone at one of my last shows in Edinburgh, like at the back, you could see their light on their phone was on, and I could see them waving to the tech, and they were like, "Excuse me," like, oh. And you know, when you can just see something's happening, and it's kind of just taking your focus a bit. And I thought someone had fainted at the back, they're trying to get them out or whatever. And then after the show, I asked my tech, like, what was going on? I'm like, oh, no, they were just asking for the Wi-Fi password, like 15 minutes into the show.
Oh, my God.
And apparently they were like part of the company as well, like part of the production company. It's like, oh, that ain't good.
It's funny when you're talking about like, you know, it's a different show every night, where I just think Edinburgh is a good place. If you're there all month, there's always that thing at the end of it where you go, oh, man, I didn't see this show or I didn't see that show. And there's my friend's show who I haven't seen and I feel bad. And then there's always a point where, like, there are certain shows, though, that I also might have seen four times. That every time I've got friends visiting, it's like, we're going to see that show again. That's what we're doing. And that's it. And shows like that are kind of perfect for it because you're getting a slightly different experience every night.
But yeah, absolutely.
But what it also is sort of like that, that as a comedian, you can often try and chase your previous show. You can be kind of like, yesterday was great. Let's try and do yesterday. And then it's not as good as yesterday. And you're kind of like frustrated. But whereas when you have that element to it where it's like, this is in the moment, this is now, it's like you forget about yesterday. And every day is a new opportunity to do something exciting, you know?
Absolutely. And I think it's that thing of not chasing that high. Because I think very early on, I learned that something that worked the night before doesn't work again. And if it was funny because it was like an improv element and everyone was in the room, it's not going to be funny because now you've rewritten that bit as a bit. And I think, yeah, really early on, I learned that because I died in the ass, like the next show, because I just tried to repeat the same joke that, you know, was spontaneous the night before. And everyone's like, what are you doing? You're like, oh, yeah, I just need to just keep having fun with it.
Allow it to be what it is. Mm. But so I guess what I would do is I would ask a question and then I would sort of over the period of time, I would work out if I say this, then this gets a laugh in any context. And there are sort of like safety measures that you kind of like build up over the month where you kind of like go, yeah, now we've got a structure to this bit of audience improv, but you still have like wiggle room. But are you like, do you just throw everything out every time? You obviously know why you've got them up. If it's the office Christmas party and you're kind of like, there's a reason for them to be up there.
Yeah.
So I think it's have go-to phrases or?
I think the structure is always there in terms of like the A to B, but how I get there or how they get there is up to them. And I think that just keeps it exciting for me most nights that I've got to be on my toes a bit as well.
I love this. And I love talking to other performers, and I have loved talking to you. Your show is called Business Dot Never Stops. I just call it Business Never Stops, but there's dots in between it all. Full stops. Steen Raskopoulos, you're on at the Soho Theatre between the 9th and 9 till 11 of September. This show, I'm gonna come and see it. I'm really excited about seeing it. It sounds brilliant. Right, this show's called Fan Club. You've got 1 minute to talk about why you like A League of Their Own.
Oh, I think it was one of the first VHS tapes that my mum and dad like recorded on. VHS.
Off the TV.
Yeah,
the Madonna Gina Davis movie.
Yeah, that's right. And it was just one that we just always watched, me and my siblings, and it was just that and Sister Act. Like, they were the only two things that we had. And yeah, I just I loved playing baseball as a kid, so that kind of had that kind of element. And apart from like Rookie of the Year or Major League, which was maybe a bit too adult for me at the time,
but baseball movies.
Yeah, yeah, I just got really heavily involved in baseball movies. The Mighty Ducks.
What about Field of Dreams then?
Of course, but I'm talking like as a six-year-old, kind of not really understanding
father and son dynamics.
Did you see recently, Nick, that they like the New York Yankees and Chicago White Sox played? They built the Field of Dreams.
Yeah, I did see that. I did see that. I didn't watch it. I heard about it, and I filed it as, I'll go back and I'll look at that.
Oh, it was so cool.
Was it good?
Yeah, and I didn't watch obviously the whole game, but I saw like the highlights, and they got Kevin Costner to walk out.
Oh, really? Fucking love Kevin Costner. Yeah, great. That is so cool. Yeah. He would have thought that was really cool as well. Yeah,
and they kind of mic'd him up. I didn't, but you just heard me go, wow, this is special.
He's such a serious man. I've like through lockdown, I've been watching Kevin Costner interviews. And he's so serious. Do you remember the Wonder Years?
As in
the TV series?
Yeah.
Not the era in all of our lives, but there was the TV. The girl that played Winnie has grown up to be like a children's author, and she writes these books that are teaching kids like maths and stuff like that. And Kevin Costner was on a chat show with her, and she was talking about like snot and stuff like that, and like talking about like how to teach kids stuff. And she turned to Kevin Costner and goes, do you want to join in? And he just goes, no. And it was like, yeah, it's not really your wheelhouse, really. It's not.
And didn't the actor who played Marv in Home Alone, he was the narrator?
Yeah, that's right. Daniel Stern, isn't it? Daniel Stern.
I think he used to direct it as well. Daniel Stern.
Oh, wow.
He does like a lot of behind the scenes stuff now. But yeah, it's weird that Daniel Stern was in a really amazing film, if you ever get to see it, called Coupe de Ville.
Okay.
Which is about three brothers that are trying to take their dad's car across country. It's brilliant. Right. Okay. It's been lovely talking to you. I mean, I feel like that hour has gone by so incredibly quickly. We've talked mainly about stand-up comedy, so a lot of our listeners will have found it a slog, but fuck them.
Yeah, hopefully.
So now what we're going to do is I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel, and we are going to play the internationally world-famous game Better or Worse.
Okay.
Steen, so Better or Worse is a game where you have to say whether the next person on the list is better or worse than the person before, based on my opinions to score points.
Oh, shit. Do I know these people?
You'll know the people, but you have to guess whether I think they're better or worse than the person.
Oh, guess your opinion.
Exactly.
Okay, that takes a bit of pressure. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Beginning with Michael Fassbender.
Okay.
Is Michael Keaton better or worse than Michael Fassbender?
I think you, Nathaniel, would say better.
It is better. Michelle Pfeiffer, better or worse than Michael Keaton?
I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer. I would say better.
I think she's probably a bit worse, but she's a high card.
Wow. Okay. Don't ever think it too much. Deep down, he really has very mainstream sensibilities.
Sarah Michelle Gellar, better or worse than Michelle Pfeiffer?
I think you would say worse.
Worse. Sarah Jessica Parker, better or worse than Sarah Michelle Gellar?
Worse, yeah.
I think maybe better.
Wow.
It's Buffy, man.
Kurt Russell, better or worse than Sarah Jessica Parker?
Better.
Russell Crowe, better or worse than Kurt Russell?
I would say better, but that's because Rusty's a... I'd say better.
He's worse.
Of course he's worse.
Mike Myers, better or worse than Russell Crowe?
Better.
The comedian or the serial killer?
The comedian.
I would say both. Both better.
Better. Kevin Smith, better or worse than Mike Myers?
Worse.
Toni Collette, better or worse than Kevin Smith?
Oh, worse.
Better.
Wow! Why would you say worse?
Toni Collette's great, right? I don't know. But anyway.
Yeah, she's great.
Carry on.
Eric Clapton, better or worse than Toni Collette?
Worse.
Yeah. Say it.
That's a 7.
Okay, you got a seven. Yes. Do you know what? This season, you're the first person to get a 7. Mm-hmm. You got a 7, which means, I mean, normally I'd say you're bang average, but the average is quite low this season. So you got a 7, which means you're not quite as good as Helena Drew with 10, Dane Baptiste, Marina Sirtis with 9, or Baz from Massive Wagons with 8. But you are better than Jamie Adams, Carl Gass, Izzy Sooty, Miles Jupp with 6, Sarah Gibbs, Laura Jean Marsh, and Steve Buscemi with 5.
I'll take that.
Yeah, it's pretty
good. Imagine being as low as 5. That's absolutely crazy. Right, so your show is on Soho Theatre. Again, I mean, I'm doing all
I
the
know you're doing great
I'm
work.
I'm doing
here.
Really well.
Between the 9th and 11th of September.
That's correct.
September, 9:30 p.m. Steen Raskopoulos, A Business Never Stops. It's been lovely talking to you today.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for coming on the show. Don't go anywhere. We need to get a photo off you. but for the purposes of the audience, we are all going now. So it's a goodbye from me.
Goodbye, everyone. There's definitely no photos being taken.
This is goodbye from Nathaniel.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Steen.
Goodbye.
Steen, we're lowering the rope ladder for the fan clubhouse. Come on up.
Lovely visual.
We'll talk about Kevin Costner and improv some more. Right, okay. I don't know why I've ended it like that. Goodbye. Look after each other. Bye.